Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 8.
I'd hazard a guess that you haven't sold one to anyone over 16 and not one girl bought one. He smiled. 13-year-old boys are big fans. Can we go now? Hulda asked. My butt's getting sore. The engineer made a wheelchair cushion for his mother from a piece of foam rubber. That pad saved her from getting butt calluses. I thanked the man with the rubber band gun and steered Hulda toward the cattle barn. I've never heard of butt calluses, I said. You've never been stuck in a chair for months, Hulda retorted. Your butt calluses up real quick if you don't have a good pad on your chair. At the barn entrance, we were hit with the odors of fresh manure mixed with hay. Many of the stalls were empty now that the judging was complete, and the rest of the stalls were full of activity as their occupants prepared to take their livestock home. We passed an empty stall where a young teen was removing the straw bedding with a pitchfork. Further down the aisle, we came upon Megan, the freckled red-headed girl who had witnessed Cosmo, the bull, get shot with a rubber band. She was cleaning her calf pen. "Hi, Megan," I said, leaning on the pen's railing. She spun around and looked at me a second before recognition swept her face. She immediately started to blush as she pulled off her leather gloves and picked up pieces of straw off her T-shirt and jeans. "You're Peter with the two old guys. I was wondering if you ever figured out who shot Cosmo." She looked down at her boots and said, "Uh-uh. I gotta clean up. My dad's coming with the trailer to pick up my calf." She spun around and put on her gloves. "Who bought the rubber band gun?" I asked, speaking to her back. "I don't know," she replied without turning. I looked over my shoulder at the stall across the aisle and a bit further away. Above it hung a Halverson Farm banner with several ribbons stapled to the bottom. "Was it one of the Halverson boys?" I asked. She turned and looked at me with surprise. She was about to say something when she looked at the banner and hesitated. "You saw their name on the stall." "What's his name?" She shook her head and walked to the railing I was leaning on. "I have to go to school with him," she whispered. "I can't tell you who it was." But as she spoke, she discreetly pointed at a blonde boy who was leading a heifer down the aisle. I winked at her, which made her blush, and rushed to the back corner of her stall, suddenly interested in something inside the igloo cooler. I patted Hulda on the arm and said, "I'll be back in a second." I walked into the unattended Halverson stall and started lifting the buckets and items stacked on the straw and hay bales in the corner of the stall. I found the rubber band gun in the pocket of a denim jacket hanging from a nail. Josh was written on the label of the coat in an uneven, childlike scrawl that would differentiate it from the dozens of other denim jackets at school. When Josh returned, I was standing in the aisle outside the gate of his stall, the rubber band gun in my hand. "Hi, Josh," I said, holding out the rubber band gun. "I think this fell out of your jacket pocket." Josh looked at me skeptically and pushed the gate open. He walked to the jacket and patted the pockets and then turned back toward me. "When did it fall out?" he asked, holding his hand out, expecting me to give the toy gun back to him. "I think you lost it right after you shot the bull. I put the gun in my pocket. If you want it back, it'll be at the sheriff's department. Ask for Deputy Barnes. I'm sure he'd like to take your statement about the incident. A man was injured when you shot the bull." Josh's eyes grew wide and his mouth dropped open. I was right there. I pointed at a stall past Megan's. What are you going to do?" he asked as beads of sweat formed on his forehead. As I spoke, a middle-aged farmer walked down the aisle and stopped at the stall. "Is anything wrong?" he asked. We exchanged names. He was Josh's dad. "We have a problem," I said, handing the wooden gun to him. "I was just telling Josh that I think Cosmo, the bull that hurt a man a few days ago, was shot with a rubber band gun. The shot came from right here, and this fell out of Josh's pocket. If you have a piece of paper, write down Hank Oldham's name. He's in a Duluth hospital with broken ribs from Cosmo's bucking. I'm sure he has an ambulance bill that won't be covered by Medicare, and it would be really nice if someone brought him some flowers to brighten his hospital room. I turned and walked away, knowing that the punishment meted out from Dad would be far worse than any sentence from the court system. I pushed Hulda's wheelchair as I heard Josh being questioned about the Cosmo event. I winked at Megan as I passed, causing another beet-red blush as Josh's father's voice got louder. "What the hell were you thinking?" I heard Josh's dad say. "Never mind, it's pretty obvious you weren't thinking. When we get home, you're going to write the best apology letter I've ever read, and you won't see the outside of our house or barn until you've earned enough to pay back whatever hospital bills I have to pay." "What was that all about?" Hulda asked. "We just solved a crime, and the punishment is being doled out." Whistling Sousa, Chapter 16. After work on Sunday, I drove to my house in the Seagog part of Two Harbors. Visions of a cold beer and a pizza sizzling in my oven were swirling through my head. That vision evaporated when I turned the last corner in my neighborhood. My elderly neighbor Dolores was standing on my front step holding a basket and pounding her fist on my door. I pulled into my driveway and got out. "Hello, Dolores. What can I do for you?" She was dressed in her usual outfit of a floral decorated dress and black orthopedic shoes that laced to her ankles. Her hair color changed slightly with each trip to the beauty salon. Yesterday it had been Battleship Gray, and today it was mauve. "I brought dinner for you," she said. "I made a tuna fish hot dish. I learned in the Navy that a hot dish is the Minnesota version of a casserole." "That's very kind of you," I said, as I took the lukewarm pan from her and opened the door. "Would you like to come in and share it with me?" "No, dear. I made it for you because I heard that O'Keefe woman in the city band died while you were directing, and I assumed that you were in mourning. I always bring a hot dish to people who are in mourning." "That's very nice, but the woman in the band only had an allergic reaction. She didn't die." "She didn't die?" Dolores asked. "The ladies at Bingo said she'd been stabbed or something." "No, she had an allergic reaction to a peanut, and I'm sure she's recovering nicely." Dolores looked perplexed. "That O'Keefe woman, is she the one who wears the sausage dresses?" "Sausage dresses?" I asked, having a mental image of Lady Gaga who'd worn a dress made of raw meat to some red carpet event. I tried to visualize someone draped in bratwurst. "Don't be so naive, Peter. You've seen sausage dresses. The tight ones that make a woman look like she's stuffed into a sausage casing." "Ah, yes," I said now, remembering Sheila O'Keefe's skin-tight dress. Sheila was wearing a sausage dress. Dolores shook her head. "She's old enough to have grown children. Women like that should dress more properly." She hesitated for a second and then said, "Oh, well, you keep the hot dish anyway." She turned and started down the steps. As she limped away, I remembered her toe issue and asked, "Did you talk to your doctor about your toe?" "They don't want to deal with black toes," she said, fluttering her hand at me. "They may not like to deal with them, but they do," I countered. "What did they offer you for options?" "The nurse told me to come in, but I'm not about to pay for an office visit over a black toe. The women at Bingo told me the doctor would remove it. If they tried to pull that on me, I'd give them a piece of my mind. It's been with me for nearly 90 years. It's hardly the time to lop it off, especially when it's only bruised." Thoughts of gangrene and blood poisoning flooded through my head, and I flashed back to wounded soldiers with flies circling their open, bloody wounds. We moved the wounded so quickly to distant hospitals that I never had to deal with the issues associated with black toes. If the doctor thinks your toe should be amputated, I would have to agree with him. It looked pretty bad to me. I got a withering glare. That doctor is young enough to be my grandson, and he hasn't experienced enough to make recommendations about lopping off people's body parts. With that declaration, she limped back to her house. I thought about asking her to show me the toe, but decided against that plan, at least for the time being. Her limp seemed less pronounced, so maybe it really was a healing bruise and not something more serious. In the kitchen, I removed the aluminum foil covering the pan and looked at a sickly gray concoction with tiny bits of mushroom showing through a sprinkling of potato chips. It was slightly warmer than the air temperature. Unsure how long it had been stored at that temperature, I decided not to risk food poisoning on the eve of my day off. I slid it into the bag of garbage under the sink and made a mental note to take the bag to the curb for the Monday morning garbage pickup. I didn't want it incubating in my garbage can. I had just stocked the refrigerator with a 12-pack of Lake Superior Lager, a specialty beer from a brewery that had moved into the historic Fitger's Brewery building overlooking Lake Superior in Duluth. I twisted the cap off a bottle and took a long swallow, realizing what a long day it had been. I popped a pizza in the oven and leaned back to check the viewing options on the dozen Duluth television channels that came through my UHF antenna and converter. Most evenings I drifted to the PBS stations, except during pledge weeks, which seemed to have gone from annual fundraisers to monthly. Nothing looked appealing, so I turned to a news broadcast. I'd nodded off into a dreamless sleep until the doorbell buzzed. I rocketed out of the chair, feeling disoriented and panicked. I threw myself onto the floor and blinked a few times before realizing I wasn't reacting to an Iraqi rocket attack. On the television, a stupid reality show was following an arguing couple as they raced through a train station trying to find a clue. I took a breath and pushed myself up from the floor and saw Jenny watching me from the open front door. Her face was pink, like she'd just scrubbed away her makeup. She'd pulled her short blonde hair into a ponytail and was wearing a bright yellow golf shirt with very short denim shorts. The combination caused instant stirring in my loins. "I wish I could stop doing that," I said, trying to recover my dignity. I pulled her close and kissed her. "It's a good thing you wear makeup at work. The little old men would be terribly distracted by the beauty you keep hidden underneath." "That's the nicest compliment you've ever given me," she said, nervously pushing a stray lock of hair behind her ear. She slipped out of my hug and sniffed the air. "Do I smell pizza? I've got a Supreme in the oven, and the timer should sound any second," I said, as I set a scarred aluminum pizza pan on the counter and dug for the slicer in a drawer full of mismatched utensils and soup ladles. On cue, the buzzer sounded. I donned hot pads and pulled the pizza out of the oven. The cheese was melted and the edges were nicely browned. "You know," Jenny said as she set two plates on the table, "a good therapist might be able to help you deal with whatever demon makes you throw yourself on the floor when you hear firecrackers or the doorbell." I ignored her comment, cut the pizza into pieces, and slid half a dozen onto two plates as she opened a beer. I thought about my mother's work to get a veterans PTSD treatment center in Duluth and wondered if I should be the first patient, I said, as we carried the pizza to the living room and sat on the couch balancing the plates on our knees. "I am under control 99% of the time and functional. That's an improvement from my return debriefing in San Diego. I'd been a mess, but was trying to keep it buried so I didn't have to go through the mental decompression treatments given to the guys who were obvious basket cases.
Why did you try to hide it? She asked as we sat on the couch. I don't know, I said, searching for the elusive answer to a question I'd asked myself 100 times. I guess it wasn't macho to let your guard down. I'm surprised something didn't come out when they did out-processing assessments, she said. Somehow, I managed to get through the screening and got accepted at the University of Minnesota in Duluth before I'd been scheduled for a discharge. The Navy let me start classes while they finished my out-processing, which allowed me to skip the final round of psych evaluations. I think that's where they might have caught my fragile mental state. How did college go? She asked, getting up and returning from the kitchen with a pair of paper towels that we used as napkins. I immersed myself in music theory, followed by hours of practicing guitar and piano. By having no downtime, I was able to skate through my college days with Jack Daniels to help me get to sleep. By graduation, I was an accomplished musician with a pretty good voice. I was also close to being an alcoholic with night sweats, afraid to close my eyes, knowing that would lead to ugly dreams. I paused, suddenly aware that a line had been crossed. I'd never shared these words with anyone who hadn't been there. What's wrong? She asked, sensing the pause. She was staring at me, not chewing. Just a stray thought, I said. I went on with a new topic. While my classmates were busy applying for jobs as music teachers, I was searching the want ads for something else. I was sitting in the Two Harbors VFW Club one Saturday night, talking with a few other vets and trying to explain my dilemma. The bartender, a Vietnam vet with shaggy gray hair, brought an old beat-up guitar from behind the bar and handed it to me. Play something, he said. Jenny said, trying to swallow, that would be Vern, the guy who built the box for your medals. I spent a few minutes tuning and then played Classical Gas, an instrumental written by Mason Williams, a top 40 hit in the 60s, written by a guy who wrote jokes for the Smothers Brothers show. When I finished, the bar erupted in applause. I'd closed my eyes and had been so into the song that I didn't realize all the conversation had stopped. I nodded thanks to the people and tried to set the guitar aside. Instead, Vern pushed it back to me, and I spent 2 hours playing requests from the crowd. Someone threw my UMD Bulldogs baseball hat on the floor, and dollar bills started fluttering in. At closing time, Vern retrieved the guitar and asked me how I got along with old people. I said I was okay with older people as I gathered the money in my cap and arranged it into a neat pile. He scribbled a name and phone number on a bar napkin and said, "Call my sister tomorrow." I thought he was setting up a blind date. I asked why I was calling his sister. He said she was looking for a recreation director. She runs some kind of classy apartment thing for retired people up in Two Harbors. She wants someone who can sing and drive folks around in a van. I wondered how you landed at Whistling Pines. My arrival was serendipity, I said, getting up from the table. Do you want more pizza? I've had plenty, she replied. Watching your girlish figure? Mother told me if I didn't watch my girlish figure, the boys wouldn't either. I didn't know Barbara was a philosopher. Less a philosopher than a narcissist who's consumed with worries about her appearance. She was just passing along wisdom in hopes I'd become as neurotic as she is. Ouch. Jenny shrugged. It's just the truth as I see it. She sniffed and frowned. Do I smell fish? Oh, heck, I've got to take the garbage out, I said, opening the cabinet and pulling out the waste can. I tied the bag shut, went outside, and threw it in the garbage can. I dragged the can down to the street and returned to the couch. I've never known you to cook fish, she said. Dolores made a tuna hot dish for me. I threw it in the garbage. You don't like tuna? Tuna is fine as long as it's hot or cold.
The casserole Dolores brought over was somewhere in between, and I had no idea how long it had been out of the oven. Good choice. I'm surprised to see you tonight. On Sunday evenings, you're usually hounding Jeremy about some forgotten homework assignment. The strangest thing happened this afternoon. My dad sent Jeremy out to mow the grass and then cornered me in the kitchen. He wanted to know why you'd joined the Navy and what brought you to Two Harbors. When we were through, he stared at me for a second like he was searching for a word. He didn't ask you if you were on the pill, did he? Jenny punched my arm. No, get serious for a minute. Okay, I'm serious. He apologized for having doubts about my judgment. He told me that he'd apologize to you, too. Then he asked me if you were having problems with PTSD. Why is everyone suddenly concerned about my PTSD? Hang on, I haven't even got to the best part yet. He told me that he'd be proud to have you for a son-in-law. I'm not sure what I should do with that tidbit, I said, wondering where the conversation might lead. Don't you think it's nice that you have his blessing when you ask to marry me? How do we get from PTSD to wedding discussions? How are you at catching hints tonight? I think the wedding suggestion was more than a hint. Daddy told me he thought you shouldn't have been alone last night after dredging up memories that caused you to flash back, so he told me to come over and comfort you tonight. He and Jeremy are going to Pizza Hut after his homework is done, and then he's taking Jeremy down to the lake and showing him how to cast a fly rod. That's really nice of him. She pulled my arm over her shoulders, gave me a gentle kiss, and threw a leg across my lap. I shaved my legs. I gently kissed her and ran my fingers up her thigh. She pulled my free hand to her breast. First and second base in 30 seconds, I said. The hit is already out of the ballpark, music man. Take your time with the rest of the bases. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 17, Monday. I made coffee and thought about my lack of an air conditioner and how hard it was going to be to sleep the next few nights. The weather pattern changed overnight, and the Monday morning Duluth News Tribune said the westerly winds would bring near-record heat the next 3 days, not that it had been cool the previous week. Most of the northern hemisphere expects southerly breezes to bring heat, but Two Harbors lies on the north shore of Lake Superior, and winds from the south and east are chilled by their trip over the refrigerator cold waters of the Big Lake. Winds blowing from the west usually bring the few really warm days we get each year, generating crowds at the golf course and sending people to wade in the numerous rivers flowing into the lake, their flows tempering the frigid water. Mondays and Tuesdays are my days off, but somehow my new role as reserve deputy made me feel compelled to return to work. Or it may have been my preference to seek refuge from the heat in the air conditioning at Whistling Pines. I rushed past the receptionist, Bonnie, who sits under an old moose head rescued from one of the downtown bars before the bulldozer took it down. The unnamed moose and knotty pine paneling add to the Northwoods feel of Whistling Pines, giving it a feel more like a lodge than a senior citizen's residence. I avoided eye contact with any of the residents, knowing it would lead to a discussion or a question about this week's bingo prizes. I drew a mug of coffee from the dining room urn and took a quick look out of the dining room windows at Lake Superior. When I walked through my office door, Brian Johnson was sitting at my desk flipping through a pile of sheet music. He sensed my entry and spun around in the chair. I thought I'd give you a day to look over the music for the Bandshell Park concert and then check in. You're lucky I came to work on my day off, I said. You're lucky I came over so you didn't have to chase me down. Thanks, I said. I really came over to see if you're still willing to be the director on Thursday. After the emergency with Sheila, I thought you might want to pass the baton. I've been thinking about the peanut in Sheila's Reed case. I'm afraid you lost me, Brian said. Sheila O'Keefe had a severe allergic reaction, I explained. Someone put a peanut in the pill bottle she was using to keep her Reed moist. Brian smiled. Everyone knew about her Reed cases. She'd pull her Reed out of a little brown bottle and noisily suck on it while she assembled her bassoon. Oh, man, I said, how did the rest of the band react?
It just added to the irritation, Brian replied. Did you notice anyone in the band or near the bandstand eating peanuts before the concert or during the intermission?
Brian thought for a second and said, eating peanuts isn't a problem for the stringed instruments or percussionists. They might get greasy fingers, but it wouldn't screw up their instruments. None of the brass or woodwinds would eat a peanut during a concert. It would foul their instruments. So you'd be looking at the drummer, the string bass player, the violinist, and the cello. That narrows the field of suspects a lot.
Sheila opened her case backstage, and then she ran on to the bandstand, so no one would have had time to put a peanut in her Reed case before the concert, unless they had access to her instrument case in her car or at her house.
The emergency room doctor said her reaction came quickly after the exposure, so she wasn't exposed to the peanut until after the intermission, I explained.
Did you notice anyone eating peanuts during the break? I asked.
No one offered me a peanut, Brian said. If that's what you're asking, that's probably the only way I would have noticed someone eating peanuts. Mostly I was talking with you and the trombonists.
So the trombonists were busy with you, so they're in the clear.
I saw you laughing. What was the topic?
Brian smiled. What happens in the back row stays in the back row.
What?
It's an old joke. The tubists, trombonists, and euphoniumists sit in the band's back row and don't tell stories on each other.
I don't think euphoniumist is a word, I said.
Brian smiled. Actually, it is a word. I've sometimes heard them called euphonists, and the British call them euphists.
Most people call them baritone players, I replied. Most people couldn't identify a euphonium if you showed them a picture of it.
Their loss, Brian said as he pressed past me and paused in the doorway.
Do you know how playing a tuba is like having elderly parents?
I shook my head.
They're both unforgiving and hard to get in and out of cars.
With that, he was out the door.
Brian, I called after him.
Yes, he said as he stuck his head around the door jamb with a cherubic smile on his face.
Do the tuba jokes ever get any better?
With a dramatic swing of his arm, he covered his chest and threw his head back.
Peter, he said with Shakespearean flair, you cut me to the quick.
After a moment, he recovered and stood normally.
I only tell you the good ones, he winked.
Is there anything else?
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.